Let's go to the next topic on the agenda, which is maintenance and consistent application. I give the floor to Javed.
Gustavo will lead us through the first few papers.
Okay.
Okay, so thank you. We'll now move to agenda papers 12A to 12D. So these papers provide our analysis of the feedback on the proposed amendments to IS 12, included in the exposure draft, deferred tax related to assets and liabilities arising from a single transaction. We'll start our discussion with agenda paper 12B. In this paper, we include our analysis of the main comments on the approach proposed in the exposure draft and our recommendations to the board. So almost all respondents agree with the board's decision to address the accounting for deferred tax related to leases and decommissioning obligations. However, many either disagreed with or expressed concerns about a number of aspects of the proposed approach. Paragraphs 10 to 43 identify the main concerns raised by respondents and provide our analysis of these concerns. In our view, the board can address most of these concerns and still achieve the objective of the amendments by confirming its proposals to narrow the scope of the recognition exemption so that it would not apply to transactions that, on initial recognition, give rise to equal amounts of taxable and deductible temporary differences, but remove what we refer to in the papers as the capping proposal. So remove the proposal to restrict the recognition of a deferred tax liability. Further, we also recommend that the board does not provide application guidance or examples illustrating how an entity determines whether tax deductions relate to the lease assets or lease liability, but provide an illustrative example explaining the deferred tax accounting for advanced lease payments and initial direct costs. I'd now like to ask whether you agree with our recommendations set out in paragraph 44 of this paper before we move to agenda paper 12C. Thank you.
Are there any comments? Tadeo?
Thank you, Hans. I have two quick comments here. One second. There is one paragraph. I'm just locating here. Sorry about that. When you said that, okay, paragraph 26. It said that, in our view, this approach would have the following benefits. And 1A1, not require an entity to assess recoverability on initial recognition. What my view is that, in any case, it will need to assess the recoverability. It's not just because we are removing the capping that they would not need to do that. I think they still need to assess, as any other deferred tax asset, the recoverability. I just thought that this sentence may make someone think that is not the case. And also, second, is paragraph 27. You said that in applying the recommended approach, an entity would recognize any difference between the deferred tax asset and the deferred tax liability in P&L for the period in profit or loss. I know that paragraph 58 of IS 12, as you put in the footnote, said that it should go against P&L, but I think that this paragraph was written considering the exception, not thinking about the situation as we have now facing narrowing the scope of the recognition exemption. I think that is, if you look at the exposure draft, the base for conclusion paragraph BC8 and BC11, I think that it sounds a bit inconsistent what we have wrote there, because in the end of the day, in a normal lease transaction, considering what's written here, a company would recognize, for example, a loss at inception. I don't think that is, it does make sense. Thank you.
Nick?
Thanks, Hans. So I remain deeply skeptical about the benefits of this project. I accept the proposals that we have will make our requirements more coherent, so that economically identical transactions are treated in the same ways, and also that this is likely to become a pervasive issue given IFRS 16. But I'm really struggling to see how the proposed changes will impact investment decisions using the financial statements. If we go back to the example that staff presented to us some months ago, which showed a tax rate of 20% when recognizing deferred tax compared to a tax rate of 36% in the first year when deferred tax isn't recognized, the implications in the real world of the recommendations are very different. You wouldn't see that differentiation, I don't believe, in those two tax rates. And that's for three reasons. So most entities will run a portfolio of leases. They won't have a single starting date. That provides a natural smoothing mechanism. And indeed, if you had five identical leases over that five-year period, the example, you get exactly the same tax rate. In the example, the only expense was a lease expense. I don't think I've ever seen a business where the only expense is a lease expense. And clearly, companies very often have multiple business lines. So I recognize it was helpful to have a simple example. But I think in the real world, that the difference and the impact on tax rates is likely to be marginal at best. And so I struggle to see how this makes a difference. I was also troubled by the complexity of our initial proposals and having seen the feedback from stakeholders. So I wouldn't have started this project in the first place. However, we do stand in a different position today. I do welcome the simplifications that are proposed, particularly removing the capping proposal. And the time and effort that's already gone into this, whether it's from our stakeholders or from the board or indeed from staff, you know, those are effectively sunk costs. There's nothing we can do about those that happen. So emotionally, I may want to say that, you know, I don't support the recommendation, but reluctantly and rationally, I think I do end up supporting the staff recommendation. But as I say, I think this is a marginal benefit to the users of financial statements. Interesting that no user responded to the consultation. But, you know, I wouldn't have started, but I think now where we are, I do accept those staff recommendations today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Nick. Bruce?
Thanks very much, Hans. I'm quite supportive of the project, having seen it come through on the committee side and the other side and kind of seeing it follow through. I know from my experience, this is something that we've definitely seen diversity on in terms of how people have approached this, whether they've raised the deferred tax, whether they haven't. So I've always been very supportive of it. I will tell you that that when the exposure draft originally came out, my one concern that nearly derailed my support for this was the capping proposal. I do agree that that raised a huge amount of complexity that when I discussed with companies, a lot of them were saying this is just going to create a lot of work. And I guess the worry about the capping proposal wasn't day one. It is when we're 5 years down the line and now we're tracking all these things. There was just a bit of concern from that. So I think it doesn't surprise me. A lot of people have come back saying they're not particularly supportive of that. So I agree that the capping proposal being removed is a good thing. As far as the examples go, I always welcome examples, and I think that it would be a good idea to have those ones around the advanced lease payments and the initial direct costs. I think those could be very, very helpful. Just one last comment I wanted to make, just to the staff. I really, really personally liked that analysis in Appendix A, where you did the diagram. I think it was a great way just to see kind of what was proposed, how it was responded to, and the comments that you'd made. So, yeah, I thought that was a really nice addition to it.
Okay. Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I also support a staff proposal. I think the original objective of this project is try to narrow the scope of the recognition exemption. But with the, you know, capping proposal, it seemed that a portion of the deferred tax liability would still be needed to be identified and still need to be within the scope of the exemption requirement, recognition exemption. So I think it caused a lot additional cost. It caused the complexity. I do agree with staff to remove that capping proposal to reduce the burden of preparers. With the idea to provide additional examples advanced lease payment and in direct initial direct cost, I also agree. Because some stakeholders mentioned this and whether they need to check all those matters and whether some people favor the BC, I think BC 16 to BC 18. Even BC 16 and 18, I think it's still not enough. So it's better to provide an example to illustrate how to deal with, account for those matters to reduce the burdens. With regard to the recoverable requirement, which Dadu mentioned, in my understanding, I think recoverable requirements for those individual deferred assets as a general principle still should apply. That requirement still specifically to identify the extent which portion related to the deferred tax liability. So this is, I think, specific to that part. So general, as a general principle, in my understanding, it should be should still require to entity to apply. So I wonder whether my understanding is correct or not.
Yes, Sergeant Chow, just to say that you are correct. I think that sentence, we were just saying that the recoverability requirement wouldn't be required to determine the extent to which the deferred tax liability would be recognized, but it would still apply in general.
Okay. Mary?
Also want to say overall support the staff recommendations, including the simplification proposed. I'd paused about the recommendation to add an example about the advance payments and initial direct costs, because I think this is where I'm the other side of the spectrum from Bruce, who said, I always like examples. I've learned to be wary and be parsimonious with how many we put in, both from the complexity of the standards overall and just thinking hard about what we needed. But in this case, I guess reluctant is the closest word I can come up with. It's the right thing, because I think there is some tension between the statement that you cited in the paper about IFRS 16 requiring the advance payment and initial direct costs to adjust the measurement of the carrying value of the right of use asset. But as I read and understand it, the point we're making about the accounting for deferred tax for those items being treated separately. So I think that probably warrants the example. Last thing I wanted to comment on is coming back to Tadeo's question about whether P&L was the right answer if there was a mismatch between the amount of the recognized deferred tax asset and the deferred tax liability. I think I'm with Jing Zhao on this. I think it is appropriate, because what you're saying is that even though even if they give rise to the same amount notionally, the entity's specific economic circumstances means that if it means that they can't recover the deferred tax asset, I think that is an economic loss as a result of not being able to capture all the benefits of the transaction. So I think P&L is the right answer. And I think we may want to make it clear in the final amendments that general principle applies. I don't think we have to give lots of guidance about it, but I think we shouldn't leave a gap on that one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Rika?
Thank you, Hans. I support staff's recommendation, and I truly think it's important to remove capping model because I welcome this amendment to IS 12, because before then, and maybe I should say currently, I can come up with at least three options to account for this situation. So it's quite important to reduce the diversity of practice here. And then also now the amended proposal will be more in alignment with IS-12's mechanism of how to assess the realization of the deferred tax asset, because principally the entity is required to look at not at individual tax difference level, but at the whole of the entity level. So, and considering that situation, especially in the current market situation, more companies will not be able to conclude full recognition of deferred tax asset of an entity. So I think a challenge explained here in the paper will be more prominent in current situation. So I think this amendment is really helpful. And also, I think the last illustrative example is really helpful, because one of the options I can come up with has a background that they consider a group of transactions is a more integrated basis as a one transaction, as a series. So in that case, I think this illustration will be helpful to understand what's the right thing to do. So thank you.
Okay, well, I sense broad support for this recommendation. Can I see who supports the set of recommendations in paragraph 44?
Tadeo? Nope. Okay, we have 12.
Okay. Very good. So, Gustavo, you move on to the next paper.
Sure, thank you. So we now move to agenda paper 12C. This paper includes our analysis of comments on the scope of the proposed amendments, the proposed transition requirements, and other matters. Paragraphs 5 to 38 identify the concerns raised by respondents and provide our analysis of these concerns. Based on our analysis, we recommend that the board require entities to apply the amendments to all transactions that, on initial recognition, give rise to equal amounts of taxable and deductible temporary differences, and require entities already applying IFRS standards to apply the amendments for the first time by recognizing deferred tax associated with leases and decommissioning obligations at the beginning of the earliest comparative period presented, and by applying the amendments prospectively to transactions other than leases and decommissioning obligations. We also recommend that the board require first-time adopters to recognize deferred tax associated with leases and decommissioning obligations existing at the date of transition to IFRS. I would now like to ask whether you agree with our recommendations set out in paragraphs 39 of this paper. Thank you.
Does anyone want to come in? No, then I suppose that we are in favor of this recommendation.
Hans, before, I'm sorry,
yes?
I was slow typing.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
I wanted to check something if I could with Gustavo. One of the things, the cumulative effect as an adjustment to the opening balance of retained earnings at the, I guess it's at the earliest date presented is what you're proposing. Sorry. An adjustment to opening retained earnings at the beginning of the earliest comparative period. Is that correct in terms of what's being proposed?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. I just wanted to check. I think from something I checked with you before the meeting, I was trying to think about whether we had a situation here where the number of comparative periods that an entity was presenting and therefore moving the date at which relief applied could have a permanent recognition and measurement difference that would carry through for a number of periods. That's something that we have thought about before. For example, with IFRS 17, most recently in terms of permission but not requirement, to do the adjustment as of the beginning of the earliest comparative period as opposed to requiring it at the immediately preceding comparative period. I just wanted to check. I think your conclusion was that there would be very few and relatively isolated instances in which that might happen. And so on the whole, it would not have any kind of long-term recognition and measurement consequences. The reason I care about this is thinking about, let's say, an entity in a jurisdiction that has a requirement for one comparative period, and that's how they do their annual financial statements. If they're also, let's say, U.S. listed and have to do a second comparative period, do they have two sets of financial statements, or do they move back their transition date just because of that U.S. listing requirement? That's why it comes up as a practical matter. But Gustavo, I just wanted to check that you thought through this and your conclusion was that there would not be a permanent, that there was very unlikely to be a permanent recognition and measurement difference.
Yeah, Mary, that's right. So I think the only situation we thought there could be a difference is if you're presenting, for example, two comparative periods and you enter into a transaction, a lease, for example, that doesn't give rise to equal and offsetting temporary differences. So I think one example is a lease that is only partially deductible. So if you enter into a lease like that during the first comparative period, then that transaction wouldn't be captured. You wouldn't recognize deferred tax for it. While if you're only presenting one comparative period, because at the beginning of the comparative period, you are recognizing deferred taxes for all leases, so you would also recognize deferred taxes for that lease that is not really in the scope of the amendment, just as a simplification. But then again, I think what we saw is that those type of transactions, such as a partially deductible lease, they're not widespread at all. I think someone mentioned that in the comment letter, but just as a kind of your theoretical point. So we're not aware of that being widespread. So we don't expect to be big differences because of that transition requirement.
Okay, then I'm fine with it. I'm always cautious about that interaction, and so want us to remember to think about it.
Sure.
Okay. Can I see if we support the staff's recommendation? Okay. Please move on, Gustavo.
I think I'll hand over to Charlie now.
Thank you. Oh. Thank you, Gustavo, and good morning. Good morning, everyone. So, I'll take us through Agenda Paper 12E now, which is the IFRIC update from the committee's September meeting. So the committee published one tentative agenda decision. The question asked about the applicability of the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 to a transaction in which an entity sells its equity interest in a subsidiary that held one asset and then leaves that asset back. And the question was really about how the loss of control requirements in IFRS 10 interact with the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. So that's what's addressed in the tentative agenda decision. Besides this, the committee also discussed and provided advice on the deferred tax amendment that we just discussed, so I will not get into any details about that. And with that, I will stop and ask if you have any questions on the September IFRIC update.
I don't think there are any questions.
Great.
So
thank you very much.